Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. This is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence and Development Corporate. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. This episode is sponsored by the Essentials of Project Management e-learning program. Yeah, there's often not a common understanding of terms and processes around your organization when it comes to managing projects. Well, this e-learning program gives everyone practical insights on how to plan and deliver projects. Check out the show notes for a coupon code to save $99 on a license through the end of August 2011. Lead projects long enough, and eventually you're going to get stuck with the problem project. Now, whether you were involved with the project from the beginning or just inheriting problems from someone else, the reality is we need to be able to rescue the problem project. That's not only true, it's also the name of a new book from Todd C. Williams. In this episode, I talk with Todd about ideas and recommendations from his book, Rescue the Problem Project, a complete guide to identifying, preventing, and recovering from project failure. Enjoy the interview. Todd C. Williams is an expert at turning around troubled projects. For 25 years, he's been helping manufacturing and service organizations build leading-edge systems, improve organization efficiency, and recover what he calls red projects. Todd is the president of E. Cameron Incorporated, a consulting firm comprised of senior-level project professionals providing company, departmental, and project setup, turnaround, and project recovery services. Todd recently published a book entitled Rescue the Problem Project, a complete guide to identifying, preventing, and recovering from project failure. Todd joins us to talk about that book today from his office near Portland, Oregon. Todd, thank you for joining us for the People and Projects Podcast.
Thank you very much, Andy. It's a joy being here.
Some years back, I was emceeing this conference, and the keynote speaker, really interesting guy, he was a fire commissioner from New York City back on 9/11. And at the end of his presentation, there was this Q&A time, and pretty interesting questions came up. But one in particular comes to mind. Someone asked a question, some along the lines of, how do you get people to run into a burning building that could crash on them? And it was interesting to hear his response, because he kind of jokingly replied at first, we don't hire normal people. And Todd, as I was getting ready for this conversation with you, I just thought, you know what? Most project managers, they try to avoid these red projects like the plague. You know, you and your organization, on the other hand, you guys run into burning buildings on purpose. So is this something you aspired to do early on, or is it something you just, you know, kind of unfolded with your career?
Andy, that's a great question. To be compared to someone as noble as a firefighter is an honor, but I've never done anything nearly as non-selfish, as non-self-serving as going out and saving people's lives for a living. Mm-hmm. I save projects for a living, and they're inanimate objects that you run into and solve. Did I actually go after this specifically as a young child saying, Jesus, this is what I want to do when I grow up? No, not even close to it. It pretty much found me. As I went through life, people would sign me tasks. I'd go out and fix them. I'd drill down into things and find the problems and fix the problems, and stuff would start working better.
Yeah.
And that was fun. I was always a person who was into making things work right, and I see a problem and I want to go fix it. Mm. And I think that a number of project managers are that way. I think that's what they enjoy about project management, is they can see a problem, they can fix it, they can build teams, they can manufacture a situation where people work well together, and then they turn that over to somebody and they have a happy customer that gives you all that positive feedback. When you have a broken project, you can dive in, there's problems to find, you can drill down and find those problems and fix them. So it's really quite rewarding, and there's really quite a few people who do this type of work and enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's great. So the big difference and where people really shy away from working on a troubled project is when they're assigned a project where they can see that there's trouble, but no one recognizes there's trouble.
Mm.
So they have the problem of trying to get into a project and try to get somebody to understand, hey, we got some issues here, we got some issues there. So people want to stay away from that because they see that they won't have support. And there's a whole set of things that someone needs to do when they're assigned to a project like that, or all of a sudden they find themselves on a project that's gone off course, that they need to do an exercise to actually make it better. So there's two different sides of that. I get called in to a project that is in trouble, and someone realizes there's a problem, so let's go fix it, versus someone else who is being assigned to a problem that is feels like it's the death knell slowly ringing away, or that they're on that death march inside the project and they're trying to figure out how to get out of it. That's where people really want to stay away from things. I think a lot of project managers, if people understand that there's a problem, people say, I've got this problem project, can you go fix it? I think there are a significant number of project managers who would jump at that chance because they can see it as a good challenge. It's intellectually challenging. It's a good thing to do.
That's a good point, really. When turning around a problem project is a chance to shine if you can do it well, not necessarily something to run from. That's good insight. One of my mentors taught me that if a team or organization, if someone's complaining about, let's say, communication, that chances are that communication isn't the problem. It's maybe a symptom of some other more fundamental problems. And I wonder if it's like that with troubled projects too, Todd. You know, what are some of the most often referred to causes of problem projects that are actually just symptoms of deeper issues?
Generally, everything that I hear about a project when I come in is a symptom. I very, very rarely hear an actual problem that ends up being something I can attack. Scope creep is probably the biggest. I mean, people call up and they complain that, Jesus, scope is ballooned, or they're working on something else. And you got to dive in there and figure out what's wrong and why there's scope creep. Is it because the customer doesn't really know what they want? Maybe they improperly defined it to begin with. Maybe it's a project manager that doesn't know how to project manage and is just letting the customer have anything they want. It could be any number of things. Quite often, we find that it's the customer doesn't really understand exactly what it is they want. They're sitting there with this vision of, I need something to do this, so they write it down, they try to describe this. They might get into a little bit too much of the how and not so much of the what I want and try to get into that implementation stuff. So they start losing some of the definition that the project team needs to actually build whatever it is that they need to do. So when you get into that, you see the customer's in a learning process, and the project is in the is taking them down this road of discovery where they're really learning about what it is that they want to build. Well, if that's the way you're going, what methodology are you using to actually get down that road? If you're using a waterfall project where you have to get all your specifications done ahead of time and everything written, well, boy, you're going to have a big problem. Either tons of change requests or you're going to just see drift and the scope is going to slowly change. If you were to do something else, something iterative, like agile, for instance, to go in and build things and get stuff in front of the customer and really be adaptive to change so that you can move things around, that might be the solution to that problem. In other cases, it might be the other way around. They might really need to have some sort of solid definition of this is what I need to do before we go to build it.
Well, a symptom that comes to mind for me is when someone says, we just have unrealistic time frames around here. They're just unrealistic. And you know, and they might be, but the underlying thing there could be we don't do a good enough job of understanding what it is, or our processes of understanding that, or putting together schedules, or negotiating skills and influencing skills. You know, it's not just unrealistic time frames. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, so you're diving into the issue of expectations is what I'm going to call it.
Yeah, that's good.
Expectations are a problem, but it's not necessarily the expectations that are a problem. It's the alignment of expectations.
Yeah.
So I hear people a lot say, geez, the customer has too big of expectations for this thing. And I return and say, well, wait a minute, high expectations are not bad. How do we get something that's innovative and new if somebody doesn't have really wild and crazy expectations? It's the alignment of those expectations so that we have the same expectations they have. Because if the supplier has the same expectations as the customer, then it gets priced appropriately, the methodology is appropriate, how we work in that situation is appropriate. So what we really want is alignment of those expectations. Hmm. If the expectations are too high that it causes too much cost or it results in too much risk, then we need to adjust those expectations for all parties and bring it down to where it's lower cost or lower risk or whatever it is. But it's that alignment that's important. And people tend to sit there and say expectations are too high.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that you really need to focus on alignment and then let the expectations lie where they need to lie.
Yeah, well said. Rescuing a problem project, it's not exactly the same as signing up for a 12-step program, but it would seem there are at least maybe some parallels to the first step, which to my understanding is essentially saying, we've got a problem. You know, I'm admitting I have a problem. So given enough time, everyone knows that if it's a problem project, they know it's a problem eventually. You know, but until it gets that bad, it too often seems like an exercise in mass hallucination. So instead of admitting we have a problem, what are some alternatives you've seen used way too often?
You know, in presentations that I have, that I give, I use the 12-step analogy all the time.
Really?
Yes, I do. I say the very first thing you have to do, whether you're in AA or Al-Anon or Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, you name it, is admit you have a problem. And mm-hmm. you can't get over that hurdle. It's a big problem. So as a project manager, let's go back to the first question, because the statement was we stay away from that project like it's the plague.
Right.
What you really need to do is you need to develop an abstraction from the project itself. You need to get out of the emotional portion of that project. Everybody else is emotional about it. You need to pull away and become non-emotional about it. So I call that you have to be passionately dispassionate.
Mm.
You're the project manager who's trying to guide things through and make things happen. So if you don't have that realization and people haven't come back and said, yes, this is a problem, then you need to get to a point where you're dealing with fact. You don't deal with emotion. You hear this person over here is a proponent, somebody else is an opponent, and you try to decide where the real truth lies and report on facts and facts only. You have to have something to substantiate everything you're saying. Then you need to have pulled into that some level of mitigation. Here is a fact. Here is a problem that we have. And here are the things that we can do to solve these. And my level of confidence for success in doing this is high, medium, or low.
Hmm.
Therefore, we need to have some sort of contingency. Now, does that sound like we're putting together a risk register?
It
sounds, in essence, it is,
yeah.
Right? So what I need to do is just be very, very factual. I then turn around and grab the attention of executives who are trying to figure out what's going on, because they see the same ping-ponging between the opponents and the proponents. They want to know what fact is. You come up and you rise above all that, you start laying fact on the table, you become the shining star.
One of my favorites is when people say, we can make this up, you know, five of the most dangerous words in project management. I mean, it's not that it can't, but hope is really a good strategy, and it seems like we get a lot of that.
Yes, yeah, so there's an immense amount of that, and unfortunately, something, when you make it things up like that,
yeah,
there's something that suffers, and generally, it's quality, it's testing. People start taking the stuff you can't quite see, it's not quite as tangible,
mm-hmm.
and that's where things start getting a little bit rough around the edges. Then you just see trouble when you get to deployment.
Yeah. So let's say someone listening, they say, okay, you know what? We've come to the realization we've got a problem project, right? So that's not the issue. But what would you say is their biggest hurdle?
Well, actually, they just crossed the biggest hurdle.
Hmm.
Truly, the biggest hurdle is somebody saying, we have a problem.
Hmm.
The minute you have that realization, you make that statement, then you can start enlisting people to help you get down that road of recovery. You can find budget, or allocate budget, or carve it out of the project. You can change scope. You can do a number of things. It's possible that you can also bring in someone from the outside. I get a lot of flack because people say, well, geez, yeah, Todd, you're going to go and promote bringing people from the outside because you're on the outside and you always want people to bring you in. And my reply to that is, to anybody who's married, at least, you know, have you ever had some sort of dispute with your spouse? Are you two really the best to work that thing out? Or do you occasionally bring in a counselor to help?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you bring in that counselor is because they're passionately dispassionate.
Mm-hmm.
they solve the problem. They look and they try to look at each side. They try to come to some median point. In a business situation, go take a look over in finance. Mm-hmm. Do they audit their own books? I don't think so. They always bring in an auditor, somebody whose skin in the game is actually to find problems, solve the problems, propose solutions, and just make sure everything's nice and at right angles and everything looks right. All the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, right?
Yeah.
So you always rely on someone to from the outside to come in. So it's a strong recommendation to bring somebody from the outside. If you're a big enough organization, multi-billion dollar, multinational company, you might be able to bring in somebody from the outside, meaning outside of your general organization, someone from somewhere else in the company.
Right.
But the problem you end up with there is culture. And they may still be so ingrained in the company culture that they can't see the real problems that are affecting the project itself.
Yeah.
When I look at a project, I draw a box of here's a project. So you kind of draw this box, and underneath it is this whole organization that runs underneath it. From the CEO down to the janitors, right? From IT over to finance to sales and marketing. And people talk about that project as if it's its own little thing and it falls apart. Well, it's riding on top of this foundation. It's things in that foundation that are wrong. And that's one of those things is culture.
Yeah.
So there's many times whenever I go in to fix a project, I literally isolate the project from that culture to get things moving again.
You know, in your book, Rescue the Problem Project, you boil down this project recovery process into a series of, I'd say they're rather straightforward steps, but one of the many things I appreciate about your book is that by making the steps simple, you don't necessarily imply that they're easy. And you do a really nice job of saturating the book with case studies to illustrate the principles. So, I want people to buy the book to get the details, but for now, how would you summarize the project rescue process?
I jokingly call it the four-step process and then immediately have five boxes up on the screen.
Nice.
Anytime I talk about it, and you'll see that at the front of each one of the sections, there's five boxes, where box one is really called box zero, and that's that realization. So we've talked about that. We don't need to talk about it anymore. Once there's that realization, you need to do an audit. You need to go in, take a look at the project, figure out what is right and wrong with the project, what's going wrong this way, right that way, etc. That is really a process of sitting down and talking to all the stakeholders. And I mean every one of them, from IT to sales, from the CEO down to the most menial person that you can find on the project.
Yeah.
Not that anybody's menial, but you know, I mean, just... I don't care.
Less influence on the project, perhaps.
Yeah. Less influence, yes, because they know what's right and what's wrong. I make a joke out of it. I pull everybody I can into a project room and say on one of the very first days, and I start talking to them about how this thing's going to work. And I say, you know, guys, gals, you guys know what's wrong with this project, and you actually know how to fix it. And over the next couple of weeks or so, I am going to come and interview and talk to you guys, and you're going to tell me everything you know. And I'm going to use that to actually develop a plan on how to fix this project. Then I'm going to go to management, and I'm going to take credit for it. Everybody laughs, but it's realism, right?
Yeah, right?
And that's really what happens. I audit it. Management is looking at all these different people who are getting all these different sides of the story. They don't know what to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that audit is kind of getting down to this is what's really wrong.
Right.
Then the next step is to analyze. So you look at everything that is going on, you drill, make sure you have the actual root cause of the problem, and start developing mitigations for each one of those root causes. And kind of test them out, see how they're going to work, see if you can make them function properly and make the project go forward. You test those ideas out with each one of the stakeholders and make sure that everything worked correctly with the stakeholders and they like the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the project, it's probably over budget, it's probably late, and probably too much scope. So you're going to have to probably take some scope out. You may have to ask for more money. You may have to ask for more time. You're going to have to get those ideas put together and kind of test them out with the stakeholders and see what sounds good and what doesn't sound good. In that process, that is the beginning of the negotiation step. because when you get everything pulled together, you have to go into that third step, which is to negotiate out a new solution.
Mm-hmm.
The new project, the recovered project, is necessarily different than the original one.
Yeah.
Because if we've just put the original one back in place, we'd have the same problems. So that third step in there is to negotiate on a new solution. So really spend a lot of time on trying to understand negotiation and how to put things together so that people understand you've actually analyzed the solution and that you're coming up with the right answer for them, and that the customer and the supplier both end up with value.
Mm-hmm.
The last step is to execute. And the execute is kind of broken into two areas. The first part is implement the corrective actions so that you have a new foundation to move forward for. Implement a new foundation so you can move forward on that. And then once you get all those in place, you then execute the new project.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is relatively simple, but it takes a lot of what's that phrase they use, the detective? It takes a lot of gumshoe work.
Yeah. But you know what I like about that, though, Todd, is sometimes you're reading a book on whether it's project management or just saying it reminds me of the old George Box quote that every model is wrong, some are useful. It's almost like they try to make it, you know, that this will work in every situation, and this is broad enough that it can be applied to different sorts of domains and but still give you a roadmap.
Yeah, it still gives you a roadmap. The thing that I need to stress here is that in the book, what I'm trying to get across is really it's people, process, then technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend an immense amount of time talking about people and dealing with people, how to read people, how to, you know, the case studies are there. So you end up with the examples. You can say, oh, okay, I see how that worked. It went this way, and you can do this to solve it. So as you get into some situation that may be similar or kind of close, then you can rely back on that to say, hey, wait a minute, I could try this little trick here and make it move that direction.
Yeah, that's good. You know, and I noticed you dedicated around four chapters or so to topics related to methodology. So, you know, what are some ways that methodology can improve project success rates?
Another thing I tell people all the time is you have to have the right methodology for what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So let's take an example of an organization that does a variety of things, an IT organization. They do everything from deploying hardware, doing computer refreshes, pulling network, to the other end of the spectrum of developing custom software for their business units.
Mm.
Those are very, very different. I can't have a network pull and run it as an agile project. You know, are we going to run it this way a little bit, see if the customer likes it, and then pull it back and do it again? And when it's all done, get permits?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think we're going to really go down the waterfall process of drawing it all out, getting permits, going through all that process. So if we're on the other end of the spectrum where people don't quite know what they need, then it might make a little more sense to use something agile-esque in
mm-hmm.
form. So we kind of get things down to a point of, yeah, that's kind of what I want, and then we can add to it and advance it and not have to write a 150-page functional specification for something we don't know what it's going to look like.
Right.
So it's very important to use the right type of process for what you're trying to do. The statement I use is if you have a portfolio of projects, you need a portfolio of processes to run them. So in the book, I talk about phasing, agile, and critical chain.
Hmm.
Phasing is as old as the hills, as long as business has been around, phasing's been around.
Yeah.
And it's literally taking the project and breaking it down into smaller chunks. Yes, it will run a little bit longer, but it won't run twice as long or three times as long, but it also decreases the total amount of headcount I have at any given time. So if I take a project staff that was once 65 people and I run that down to being three phases where I only have 20 or 25 people, the communication's easier, the coordination's easier. It's something that people can see, and they can actually work on that chunk at a time, get that deployed, start reaping the value, and move on to the next phase.
Yeah.
I've used Agile and used some of the pieces of Agile. I don't implement necessarily the whole thing, and do some part of the project in something that looks very, very agile-esque in form. And there's an example of that in detail in the book.
Mm.
critical chain allows you to look at the estimates and really focuses on that, how people are actually making those estimates and how they're biased by the sociological influences around them from their boss, from their peers, everybody else. So that's important, getting people dedicated to their task. Now, that comes out of both Agile and critical chain. Both of them say people have to be dedicated to the task. Multitasking does not work. Getting people pulled and putting them into a team away from external influence is a huge advantage.
Yeah.
I use Agile a lot. I use some of the principles a lot. That's probably the one I use the most. It's hard, though, when you're in a recovery situation to implement a brand new philosophy.
Right.
Because those philosophies to truly be implemented have to be top down. Management has to buy into it. So generally I can implement them and people say, yeah, that was great. You want to do that for the next project? Oh, no, no, no. We don't want it to screw up. And so they look at it, unfortunately, as being something to fix a project and not to do them right to begin with. I have had companies turn around and look at it the other way. So there's a lot in there. There's the one chapter in there is comparing classical waterfall type project to critical chain to agile. And I think that's a very valuable chapter for people just saying, okay, where can I implement pieces of these things to make stuff work right for me and get that project moving?
Yeah, I really like that, Tab, because, you know, you can find a lot of methodology bigots, right? You know, that this is, you always have to do critical chain. Or if you're not doing agile, you know, you're just like so, you know, 2002, right? This is just something I notice in a lot of your writing. It's, What is the need, and then applying the most appropriate tool or processes to that instead of just going in with that one thing. And sometime back, I asked listeners for what's a question you'd love to be able to ask guests. And one question that came in was, you know, ask people if there's a situation in which what they're teaching doesn't work. So let me ask you this. Can you think of some conditions or maybe characteristics of a project, Todd, that the process that you talked about there, it just wouldn't be as relevant for?
Well, the process doesn't work at all, and I've actually been caught in this. Whenever, back to that realization thing, if people don't realize that there's a problem, then the process doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay, and I've been caught in that because I use this, it's kind of ingrained in my head, and I'm used to it and all that. I've been assigned to a project where people said, hey, everything's just fine, no need to worry. And I start digging into things, and I find incongruencies, and I start highlighting those, and I end up being called a naysayer, right? I'm not being realistic anymore. I'm not being this champion for the project because I'm still wearing my passionately dispassionate hat. And that is where you can get into trouble because management doesn't want to see that. You need to turn off some of that and start just laying the facts out in front of them and saying, here's what's wrong, here's what's wrong, here's what's wrong, here's how we might be able to fix it, asking for that help. If you try to actually execute the process without somebody being there, you can get hit pretty hard. It's happened to me. I mean, and I'm the one who wrote the book.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, I gotta go read that chapter again, learn about it here, because it just seems so common sense, and you get into trouble. As far as that passionate, dispassionate, that I think almost every project manager on any project, be it failing or successful, that's what they should be. They need to be that neutral party. They really are working between the customer and the supplier, whoever those two people are, internally or externally. And they're that neutral, honest broker that sits in the center and tries to make things happen.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Probably the biggest thing that you can apply to, in my opinion, absolutely any project.
Yeah, that's a really good point you make. I mean, you mentioned that, like, if we don't realize there's a problem and admit it, then the rest of it doesn't work. But, you know, even if you realize it, but you jump straight to negotiation without auditing and analyzing, it doesn't work, right? So there really is logic to that. Yeah. You know, something I've noticed myself, as well as the experts that I interview like you, that it's easy for us to write about this stuff, right? It's easy for us to give a keynote or a workshop, and we can struggle times to practice what we preach, though. You kind of talked about that just a bit ago. So of all that you write and speak about, Todd, what would you say is most difficult for you to practice yourself?
The most difficult thing for me to practice is what I just said a few minutes ago, which is I see a problem and I don't comprehend that someone else doesn't see the same problem I see.
Yeah.
and being thorough and clear in trying to describe that as a problem that they understand. We're still dealing with people. Regardless of what happens at the end of the day, it's still people. You, in a long time ago, you asked me a question about, you know, communications is, you know, just the symptom.
Right.
Well, this is where we're back to communication. I need to communicate this in a way that that person can understand and not feel threatened.
Yeah.
So when I run into something where there is a problem, then what needs to happen is I need to figure out a way to get that person to understand without them having to feel like they're part of the problem. My favorite is to go through the assumptions real quick and try to find an assumption that's no longer valid and say, oh, look, here's an assumption. This isn't valid anymore, is it? Oh, no, it's not. Oh, well, because of this assumption not being valid, look what happened.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden it's not that person. It's not the sponsor. It's not the customer. It's not the supplier that's wrong, because we're in a world where we love to have blame. And now you can all of a sudden say, oh, assumption went haywire. It wasn't right. Let's move on. Let's figure out how to solve that problem. Okay? And so you kind of diffuse this so people don't start taking blame or wanting to assign blame, I should say.
Yeah, my answer to this would be I can fall on both ends of a spectrum here. One being way too optimistic, you know, like, hey, come on, no, come on, we can do this, you know, but not acknowledging how bad it really is. Maybe because I don't pick up on it, but you know, I can fall in that trap. But you know, to be perfectly honest, I can fall in on that other side too, of like, we are doomed, it cannot be resurrected, and what I find is if once I get out of both sides of those, and I just like to tell project managers, you know what, it's neither good nor bad, it just is. And once we can just acknowledge that this is what it is and get our grasp of reality without getting into a principal discussion about what, you know, our philosophical discussion about what reality is, but as best we know, this is what it is. And your roadmap in the book, Todd, just does a very nice job of helping people, whether they are highly experienced or whether you're, you know, a brand new project manager, of how do we deal with these situations. And you know what? If we're in this long enough, we're going to be in problem projects. It's just a matter of time. So, Todd, it's a real pleasure talking to you today. For those who are listening, if you want a practical and actually entertaining guide to rescuing a problem project, I recommend you get a copy of Todd's book. It's called Rescue the Problem Project, a complete guide to identifying, preventing, and recovering from project failure. You know, I also recommend you check out Todd's blog, Back from Red, as well as the website for E. Cameron. You can find links to all these in the show notes for the cast. Now, Todd, I really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you for joining us on the People and Projects podcast.
Thank you very much, Andy. It's been enjoyable. I'd love to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Make sure to check out the links in the show notes for more about Todd, his book, and his organization. Also, a quick note, the People and Projects podcast is now on Facebook. Check the show notes for a link to our page, and if you're a Facebook user, I invite you to stop by and join the discussion. I'll see you there. Well, thank you for joining me for this episode of the People and Projects podcast. Have a great week.
Break.
Yeah, no problem.
This is nice having editing.
You know, it is so true. Is it my cologne? Are you allergic to
it? It must be.
No.
I just opened my window to get some cool air in here. That's probably the problem.
Passionate.
You have to be,
passionately dispassionate. Yeah, I like that because it. Sometimes people say, hey, you know what? You got to take all emotion out of it. And yet we are innately emotional creatures, right? But I think that captures kind of both sides of it. So you got to stay to the facts, but you have to have passion about this too. I like that. All right. Take care, man. See ya.
Okay. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.